lawyer. Jude has warned me against preaching heresy. So, anyway, I get to talk about law. That's a pretty fearsome subject. I put that up there for the very reason that that, in many ways, kind of sums up the whole of chapter 4. Faith starts out as something, you know, is always faith. It's there, it's so on. Faith does not give us, however, absolute certitude. And that's something that as human beings we want. We want our toys to work. I'm having a dispute with Earthlink right now. I just transferred my email over there and it is not working right now. So I'm going to have a big argument with them later today. Faith enables us to live with things that aren't perfectly clear. We have to live with mystery, the things that are hidden. The Bible gives us only one answer. That's God. That's Yahweh. Yahweh is the constant. God is the constant. And in view of God, everything else becomes relative. I know Benedict the 16th, B16, often speaks of relativism. I'm not sure quite what he means by it, except it's maybe anybody who dares to question anything that he says. One of the things we attempt as human beings is to find certitude. And in one sense, we keep trying to replace God with things that aren't quite as formidable. The Jewish people always kept trying to find other things. They kept finding Baals. That was Baal and Astarte. Those were the two major gods that they contended with. Baal was the male and Astarte was the female. And so they had a male and a female god. So fertility and fruitfulness, all of that was wrapped up in two pictures. But we keep trying to find some other way other than this God who we sometimes find very sort of fearsome. And so we end up many times in a multitude of idolatries. And olatries. Oh yeah, we got money-olatry and sex-olatry. We've got pope-olatry, bishop-olatry. We've got church-olatry. We've got law-olatry. We try to find all sorts of ways that we can get certitude and be absolutely sure of what it is that we're supposed to do. And unfortunately, churches tend to be pretty good at that. You know, one of the things that we have is guilt. And they say Jewish people are very good at guilt. Well, we're not very far behind. We have managed over the years to give ourselves a real big case of where do we find guilt? What can we feel guilty about? And there's no shortage of things. If we listen to the teachings, Catholic, Jewish, Protestant, I don't care where, there's a lot there that can give us that feeling of guilt. Oh, I've done these terrible things and so on and so forth. But Paul keeps telling us, nothing comes between you and the love of God. Nothing. Church, pope, bishop, no. We try to put morality in there. I'm not docking morality, but it's one of those things. We try to put it in the middle as kind of a counterfeit for God. I live a moral life. I don't cheat on my spouse. I don't beat my kids up. Maybe I browbeat them a little bit, but it's not beating them up. I don't steal. That's a law. Kind of morality kind of sneaks in there. And if I do all these moral sorts of things, well, then I'm good. And Paul keeps reminding us, and particularly through Galatians and Romans, and if you have never read those two books, in their entirety. I invite you to sit down and read them in their totality. Don't read a part and then say, oh, this is what the whole thing is about. You have to read the whole thing. Because if you take bits and pieces, you get a skewed picture. Okay, you've got to take the totality, particularly in Romans. Because if you don't read the totality and look at it as a whole, you can kind of get messed up. I part of preparing for this, I sat down and again reread both of those epistles, both of those letters. Galatians is a little easier because it's shorter, but Romans makes you squirm a little bit more. Sometimes I think we need to squirm. So, what is morality? It's a guide. It's something that helps us get started. One of the things we and Paul keeps mentioning this in various ways, grace and law are in tension. They're pulling at each other. Okay? And so we can either have, as a result, we can have religion as requirements. Do this, do that, do the other thing, or we can have it as transformative, as changing us. And really, that's what Paul is all about, the point he's trying to make, is that we take this law and we go beyond it. Now, Rohr talks about law, prophets, wisdom, the three big sections of the Hebrew Scriptures. The Torah, the first five books, and even a little bit beyond that, that's the law. This is what we've got to do. And it's all sorts of narrative in there and so on, but it's law. One of the interesting things is you know, we've heard that the Jews had 630 different prescriptions of the law. Something around that number, I don't know. 630 sticks in my brain. Well, this is the code of canon law of promulgated in 1984. When I was in the seminary, we studied the 1917 code, but it got revised. And there are 1,752 things in here, okay? And what I have often found interesting, and it's the last little chapter, is the manner of procedure in transferring pastors. Pastors, parishes, and so on. It's fairly mild, but that all of this is to be applied with due regard for canonical equity, and here's the kicker. Having before one's eyes the salvation of souls, which is always the supreme law of the church. I'm not sure that gets observed in reality sometimes by exception. We've all suffered with pastors and priests and bishops who are strange. I'm trying to be nice. Okay, and but that's what law does. Okay, we start off with law. We've got the Ten Commandments, we've got the various prescriptions, tradition, custom, all of these things enter in. This is the way we do it. Sometimes we say that's the way we've always done it, which isn't true. But law gives us structure. Because when we're little, we're pretty well unstructured. Parents who have two or three screaming kids running around the house know that. It can be pretty unstructured. So, we get some discipline. We get some getting it together. What law should do and what the Torah should do in the Hebrew Scriptures is steer us to something more. There's more there. It isn't just the law, but, you know, see, without law, we don't stand still long enough to pay attention. That's what law helps us do. And, you know, we have Adam and Eve's thing with the Garden of Eden. And what was going on there? It was that struggle with law and with going beyond law. Paul's inner structure, inner stress. I put marks in here. This is my favorite Bible, by the way. It's the Inclusive Bible. You can get it from Quixote Center. They sold it 17% below market. That's what I just looked like yesterday. Chapter 7. Yeah. Paul is saying, does it follow that the law is sin? Of course not. Yet I wouldn't have known what sin was except for the law. And I didn't know what to covet meant until I read, no coveting. But sin seized the opportunity afforded by the commandment, produced in me every kind of covetousness. For apart from the law, sin is dead. And I once lived outside the law. But when the commandment came, sin sprang to life and I died. He goes on, the law is holy, and what it commands is holy, just, and good. But does that mean that something good killed me? No. But sin, to show itself in its true colors, used that good thing to kill me. Now sin, thanks to the commandments, exercised all its sinful power over me. Rather different. Okay? This is why you've got to read those two books in their entirety, because otherwise you kind of get wandering around. But you know, Paul is saying, I don't do the things that I want to. I do the things that I don't want to do. We have that conflict. Paul had to be a mystic, be well integrated, and yet he recognized still that conflict, that tension. Okay? And so law serves as a guide. It points us to what God really wants from us. And law, mercy, compassion, love. That's really what the law wants us to get to. That's the purpose of law. Israel kept missing the point of the law. They were wandering into all of the enticements of the surrounding cultures, and you hear the prophets inveighing against Baals and Astartes. Okay, Astarte, Baal and Astarte, they always talk together, physically. Okay, that was part of what the whole idea was, because they saw male and female as being very essential to life. And so they worshipped many times, and this was the culture they lived in, all of this as very important, you know, as the essence of life and so on. So they kept wandering off. Now, we need to take a step beyond law and we get into a little criticism of law. What is it that law is trying to get me to do? That's what the prophets come in. Don't we so often think of the prophets in the sense of proof texts for Jesus, for this, for that, the other thing? It was the furthest thing from the minds of the prophets that we can imagine. They were writing for the Jewish people at a particular time in their history. Now, scripture scholars tell us that the prophet Isaiah, if we take it literally, he lived about 200 years. Because scripture scholars say there's 1 Isaiah, 2 Isaiah, and 3 Isaiah. You've got 3 different authors all pushed together in the one book. And different eras. You've got pre-exile, you've got during the exile, and after the exile. It's all there. And scholars can discern by the topic, how it's approached, the vocabulary, the structure, how it was written. Because anything I write is going to be my style, right? no matter how serious I write as me. Keith would write very differently than I would. He'd tell more jokes. So we want to look at the prophets as telling us how to go. Now, Richard Rohr talks about the ego. I have a tendency to say ego because I studied Latin and I learned how to say ego. That's ego in Latin, okay? So if I slip, that's why. We want to move away from the ego structure, which gives us false security, and into self-critical thinking. We've got to start asking ourselves, why am I doing this? Why do I think and feel and believe this way? Now, if we don't get to self-critical thinking, we don't get to any deep well. We're still very superficial, very much bound up in law. And so we need to get beyond that, okay? We need to be critical of ourselves and the system in which we exist and the system in which we live. And if we become critical of the system, and all of us are in one way or another, we wouldn't be here otherwise, critical of that system. So we've also got to, as the prophets did, accept rejection. There are those who won't like us, who won't like what we're saying, who think we're Beelzebub personified. We have to accept that. Wisdom, the third leg of this, leads us into integrative thinking. We begin to put it together. We begin to get the wisdom of the scriptures, okay? We have to become secure with mystery. Complex issues that are never going to get resolved. A good Jesuit one time, he was a liturgist, which is almost an oxymoron. Jesuits are not known as being liturgists. But he used to say that God is the one who dwells in unapproachable light. And when you stop and think about it, that means God is mystery. It's another way of saying it. We're never going to fully lay hold of the totality of this God. It just doesn't work. And so we have to learn with a little bit, live with a bit of ambiguity. We have to live with uncertainty. How we are describing God, is that the way we're going to describe God always? And, one of the things we have to do is integrate all of that with the rest of our universe. And so this is why you're getting theologians like Dermot of Moshu, good Irishman, Michael Morwood, good Aussie, and others. They're getting into this whole thing of integrating our concept of God with what we learn from science today. Because if we don't integrate it, we're going off in two different directions. Okay? So, one of the things that wisdom leads us to is the conclusion of the book of Job. Poor Job. He sat around there on the garbage heap. He had sores. He wasn't a pretty sight, and his friends kept telling him, "I'll curl up and die." Such friends. But ultimately, the conclusion, even when God appears as the final summer up, the one who sums up everything, God says, "Well, you've got to take some things on faith." That's what it comes down to. There are things which we can't explain. There are things in life which are inexplicable. Jeff said that right. So, what is it? We start with law. We move to a positive criticism. We struggle into consciousness. And then we come to integrating consciousness and faith, bringing it in together. Okay? We break through to patience with mystery and paradox and suffering, limitations. We've got to realize those things. All of these things are part of it. Jesus gives us total integration. He got it all together. Wisdom. out of that grew a whole new religion, which is always misunderstood. Because so many people misunderstand it. They look to religion for answers, for absolutes. And you can take the Bible and you can give them some absolutes, but you're not giving them the whole Bible. You've got to take, and see, this is again, you've got to take the whole picture. You can't just take pieces. So, one of the things we also have to realize that no matter how far we advance, we still got those first two pieces with us. Law and prophets. Law and criticism. We get into to feeling more unified and getting it together, getting into the wisdom end of things. And the other two still keep dragging along with us. They're part of us. You know, it's there. I'm never going to get rid of them. I just have to accept that that's part of my personal baggage. It's part of what keeps me struggling to get it all together. That's what we got to do. Now, Matthew's Gospel. You know, Rohr has a section here. The actor with the plank in his eye. Ooh. Actor is a Greek word. In our scriptures, it's translated as hypocrite. But if you read through, like for example, chapter 23 in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus told the crowds and the disciples, "The religious scholars and the Pharisees have succeeded Moses as teacher. Therefore, perform every observance they tell you to do. But don't follow their example. Even they don't do what they say. They tie up heavy loads and lay them on others' shoulders, while they themselves will not lift a finger to help alleviate the burden. All their works are performed to be seen." And he goes on, and you know, he talks about their phylacteries and their tassels and their robes and their finest places at banquets and so on. They love to be called rabbi. Well, and he said, "But as for you, avoid the title rabbi. You have only one teacher, and you are all sisters and brothers, and don't call anyone mother or father." He's speaking spiritually, okay? Now, yeah, we've got male and female parents. That's how we get delivered here. He goes on to say, "You have only one parent, our loving God in heaven. Avoid being called leaders." And then he gets into the woes. "Woe to you religious scholars and Pharisees, you frauds." And he keeps repeating that. And then he goes through. "You travel over land and sea to make a single convert. And once that person is converted, you create a proselyte twice as wicked as yourselves." Chapter 23 of Matthew. Okay? So, Jesus is pretty tough on that. You know, what we've got is the ego and the shadow. The ego is that face we present to the world. That's how we like to be known and seen. And the ego wants to be central, significant, some of it's well-defended, self-protective, wants to eliminate any negative about itself so that it can succeed. The shadow is what we don't want to see about ourselves. We're afraid of it. We want to hide it from others, and we want to hide it especially from ourselves. We always like to think we're better than we are. See, this is where criticism comes in. And so the actor puts on a show. The hypocrite puts on a show. Addicts would tell us that we're in denial. Yeah, we're in denial. Yeah, but often we are. And if we get our shadow self over defended, it becomes hated, and we project it elsewhere. You know, we've had the example in recent years of ministers, priests, who have been so down on homosexuals. And it turns out they have been guilty of homosexual behavior. They may be bisexuals, I don't know, but it's that. So sometimes we hate the very thing that is within us and that we're afraid of. We are afraid even to name it to ourselves. You know, the rationality that abusers often have is that it's good for them. Or an abuser, a priest who's on the prowl for a woman. Oh, well, you know, God wants us to do this. No. So we have to watch what we're after. So the shadow self can do a lot of things. What Jesus criticizes is hypocrisy. You never hear him criticizing sinners. For them, there is mercy, forgiveness, and compassion. It's the hypocrites that he goes after. It's the actors. Okay? And I don't mean a person who gets up on the stage. Okay? Shadow is, in many ways, not the whole problem. It's what religion often does, is it goes after the shadow. That behavior. We can't get rid of the shadow. All we can do with the shadow is expose its game. Expose the game of the shadow and it loses its potency. It loses its power. In Ephesians, Paul tells us that anything that gets exposed to the light turns into the light. So if we take that shadow part and we get it out in the open, at least to ourselves, we can deal with it. We can live with it. We can know what's going on. Jesus and the prophets deal with the cause of shadow, the overly defended ego. That self that we want to project to the whole world. And so we need to, you know, Jesus wants to attack that real problem in us. And in Israel, the ego and arrogance of the nation. They did these things, they obeyed this law of Moses, and therefore they were wonderful. But the prophets kept saying, mercy, compassion, love. Mercy, compassion, love. And Jesus, one time, he takes the Pharisees to task. You say, oh, I've given all this money to the temple, therefore I don't owe my parents any support. So he goes into the real problem, people misusing power. See, when we expose the shadow in ourselves, it loses its power over us. We've got the plank out of our eye, and then we can see the speck in our brother's eye, and usually by that time, the speck doesn't bother us anymore. Okay? Shadow doesn't lead us to personal transformation, empathy, compassion, patience, but shadow can lead us in two different ways. To denial or disguise, repression, hypocrisy. So we can end up in being very great cognitive rigidity. The Baltimore Catechism taught me, I said that to Jim, I'm picking on you, Jim, sorry. But the Baltimore Catechism, yeah, we had it. I grew up with that. I think I got an A in every religion test, you know. I memorized the supper. I don't remember hardly a word of it today. That was loaded answers, okay? Or the other side, cognitive rigidity, and or very hateful people. Very hateful people. I think today in our culture, the anti-abortion zealots, I'm not saying abortion is good, no, but those who have made it the only sin, the only issue. I accuse them myself of being pro-birth and anti-life. Think about that one. Every now and then I get good thoughts. I get kind of an insight into something. Now, Paul talks about the real sin, or Rohr talks about the real sin. So, see, what Jesus wants to do is undercut the ego. We want to get rid of self-validation and cold calculation. Sermon on the Mount. Sees pride, self-sufficiency, the resultant hypocrisy, as primary moral problems. The community of the Beatitudes here. Yes. That's what they're trying to model themselves upon, is the Beatitudes. Which history tells us, historians will say, okay, the early centuries of the church, this was a church that was guided by the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of God. But when Constantine came along, we kind of put away because we became the dominant, not the underground. Okay? Jesus tells the scribes, Pharisees, you have neglected the weightier matters of the law. You've neglected them. Justice, mercy, good faith, Matthew. Okay? Jesus addresses the radical cause of evil, not just the symptoms. And see, and this is what we have a tendency to do. You know, when I was growing up, most of us when we were growing up, we learned a definition of sin. Any thought, word, or deed contrary to the law of God. Baltimore Catechism 1. that was the first grade version of it, you know. Any thought, word, or deed contrary to the law of God. Well, and then it goes on. To be really big bad sin, it requires full knowledge, grievous matter, and full consent of the will. That's law. That's a legal, juridical definition of sin. We lost the biblical sense of sin, which is the ultimate personal struggle. That's what they mean by sin. Okay? Now the juridical thing lets us identify shame and enforcement. Identify shame and enforce. Those are the three things that the juridical view of sin does. Now, how many people, when we were little, when I was little, first confession, I disobeyed my mother three times, I told lies twice, and then, isn't that what we learned? It has nothing to do with sin. And yet, some people are still stuck in, that's what they do when they go to confession. All of these little things that are just part of being human. They're not really sinful. They may not be very perfect, but they're certainly not sinful. And the other things get neglected. You know, we became obsessed with external behavior. The hot sins, you know. Sex. The hot sin of the day. How many people have been drummed out of office because they got into the wrong bed? Male and female. Look what we did to poor Tiger Woods. Now maybe he had a real problem, but we took it and we shook it out and we hung it before the whole world. How about greed? ambition. Those are some pretty big issues as far as I'm concerned. But that isn't as much fun as sex. So they identify this. Now, tension of law versus grace stays with us. Sermon on the Mount, whatever. The natural ego has a great desire for purity codes, group identity. Instead of being able to stand, Galatians and Romans is all about meaning, purpose, the limitations of law. But unfortunately, it hasn't had a lot of effect on the Christian idealization of law. Because we can, when we get fixated on law, we can drag out a few items and kind of polish them up. And in a human sense, we can kind of do these little things. I'm not telling so many lies anymore. They don't get us very far. Laws can only give us information, even helpful information, but they don't bring us to transformation. We need a change. Transform ourselves into the likeness of Christ. That's largely what we're all about. You know, it's where we need to go. See, we're not justified by the law. Law only makes us aware of sin. Paul keeps harping on that in Galatians and Romans. Law doesn't do the job. And he keeps telling you, you're free of the law. You now enjoy the freedom of the sons and daughters of God. Well, now, there were those who interpreted that to mean, I can do anything I want. I don't have to follow any sort of moral code. But Paul says, no. You're missing the point. Okay? We need to look at those things. There's so many good things in Romans, you know. While Israel, looking for righteousness that comes from the law, failed to do what the law required. Why? Because Israel sought righteousness based not on faith, but on works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone mentioned in Scripture. The rock to trip them up. Okay? And we're told Jesus can be that rock that trips us up. Because the law is necessary. It's stage one. It's what launches us. But it can't be the end. Law can frustrate transformation if it can become an end in itself. So we've got Joe six-pack Christian. Joe and Jill six-pack Christian. Okay? Got to get the wives in there too. And we get a certain set of things, and we do those, and we figure, hey, we got it knocked. And we don't.
In this chapter somewhere, I was looking for it, but I can't find it. Richard Rohr says that the church has somehow de-emphasized the role of prophets. You know, we don't hear much about the prophets in our liturgies and so forth. And then I thought, yeah, they're dismissive of today's prophets.
Yes, we always have been. The Jews were dismissive of their own prophets. Look how many of them got slaughtered in various ways. Was it Jeremiah got thrown into a muddy well until some of his friends complained to the king and they pulled him back out. Poor Jeremiah really had a battle. He didn't want to be a prophet. And at one time, he said, I'm going to stay home. I'm not going to go out there. I'm not going to do this. And see, it burned in him. This is the description in Jeremiah. And so what ended up, it became so bad, he just ran out into the streets. He forgot to put on his robes. Well, they didn't make quite as big a deal out of nakedness as we do. Okay. sometimes, you know, that's where we hope to get to. It would be lovely to get there, where the fire of God's love burns so fiercely within us that we would be absolutely fearless in telling other people about it. We would be able to accept the faith of the prophets. Rejection. I know I've done a number of things that probably would, I know, would get me in immediate ecclesiastical hot water. I was there at Reverend Suzanne's ordination, and I laid hands upon her. And then later on, when they ordained four women as bishops, I was there as a representative of Corpus to present rings to the bishops. And then everybody else went around and laid hands on them. I did too. Roger might not be able to restrain himself. He might clobber me. I don't know. Roger was 2 years behind me at the seminary, so I, you know, I figure, what the heck? I know some of his secrets. So, law is, you know, really important. So we have to distinguish the gospel of Jesus from regular moralistic religion. And unfortunately, we get into moralizing in religion and not enough into mercy, justice, compassion, love. Those should be the hot button issues. How do we treat, and if you read the prophets, widows and orphans and the poor? Of course, widows and orphans were poor. How did the people treat them? That was the criterion that the prophets went after and after. And Jesus says the same thing. Can't save the sinners. The well people don't need me. They don't need the physician. They don't need healing. See, what God has to do, and that's why Richard Rohr calls this chapter the boxing ring, God has to get us into the right boxing ring, involved in the right issues. Now, the container is law. It kind of gets us going. But we have to really discern the contents in that container, and the law serves to teach us that we really cannot obey the law by ourselves. You know, in one sense, we have got to play with law and work with law until it frustrates the hell out of us. And law is frustrating when we really stop and think about it. You know, we need a certain level. The letter of the law brings death, but the Spirit brings life. That's Paul, okay? He had a quote from Karl Rahner in there. Karl Rahner was the great theologian of the Second Vatican Council and following. Hans Kuhn also, and at that time, Joseph Ratzinger. But he got scared and backed up. And I've got a friend that can tell me this, that can tell us the story of Ratzinger's turn to the dark side. Well, that was one of the names that was given to Ratzinger when he was head of the CDF. He was called Darth Vader, or Darth Ratzinger. Anyway, Karl Rahner, we must show men and women today at least the beginning of the path that leads to credibility and concretely into the freedom of God. But have no doubt, freedom is the goal. Where men and women have not begun to have the experience of God and of God's Spirit who liberates us from the most profound anxieties of life and from our endless guilt, there is really no point in proclaiming to them the ethical norms of Christianity. Justice, mercy, compassion, love. The ethical norms of Christianity. Now, Karl Rahner was very astute in that.
I was just going to comment that on that same page before that, he was talking about, gave a vignette of Father Richard McBrien. He and Moore were criticized, called bad, called liberal, called awful things. On the page here. And he's talking about what you're saying. Go back to the law. That's where we all came from. But now we have to be grown up. We have to mature, and we have to have the tension.
I think what Brian said, if you want more people like us, keep pushing the law and you'll get more like us. Speak out and call a spade a spade. You know, okay. Yeah, very good. You know, when we talk about law, I put up this quote from the Dalai Lama. And really, we've got to learn the meaning of law very well, so that you will know how to disobey it properly. Yeah, because we can't always obey the strictures of law. Sometimes we have to look for the loophole. In canon law, and I learned this in the seminary, there is a word, a Greek word, epikaia. It means knowing how to interpret the law, and particularly to interpret the mind of the legislator. Now, would they really want this to apply in this way, in this situation? I was real good at asking myself that question. I did a lot of things on that basis. I just didn't tell anybody about it.
I have a good example.
There's an old maxim. It's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is to ask for permission.
I have a good example of how not to do this. In other words, there is this old law that says, you find it on restaurants, it says, no shirt, no shoes, no service. Now, the way to disobey it improperly is to go into the restaurant just wearing a shirt and shoes. That's not what they meant.
Good shot, Tom. That's a goodie. Okay, we've got to get into this ethical levels of Jesus. You know, what is Jesus trying to teach us? And mercy, love, compassion, justice from God's point of view, not ours. Okay? Morality needs to become the place where the dance of love begins. It shows itself in law. That's where we got to get to. Moral issues are necessary struggles with freedom and conditioning. You know, struggles between the me and the not me, the apparent self and the true self, the ego and the shadow. We've got to work on those. We need to learn who is doing things with us, through us, and for us. We've got to learn how God operates and allow and admit that I can't do it myself. We want law for order, obedience, moral purity, and God and Paul are challenging us toward divine union to force the honest person to stumble and fall into God. We do need to stumble. I'm convinced of that. I know I need to regularly. And I do. I don't actually, you know, I know me pretty well now. Spirituality sees law as a means, not an end. Break away from that institutional identity. You know, the Spirit is supposed to wake us up. And Gospel of John, you know, Jesus talks about the paraclete, the divine defense attorney who's got to come to us. And John says, when the Spirit comes, he will show the world how wrong it was about sin, how wrong it was about who was in the right, and how wrong it was in its judgments. The Spirit that is God, that is wisdom. So, theia, fiat, wisdom. Hey, that's what we want. Okay? So, black and white law doesn't work. We've got to realize that that in the old black and white films, almost everything was gray, varying shades thereof. Film noir was great in gray. You know, everything, and they had lots of shadow, things hidden. And that can be a good metaphor for life, too. You know, we've got to attack with, see, what we do sometimes is we raise people up with black and white thinking and then they leave. And when we say, why did you leave? They attack us for the same reason, thinking we gave them. How many people do we meet today? I'm a recovering Catholic. I'm a recovering Baptist. I'm a recovering Christian. They've cut it all loose because all we gave them was black and white and nothing of love, mercy, compassion, God's justice. Okay? So, you know, you give them the rigidity and it backfires. Look what has happened in just recent years in Poland and in Ireland. I think Ireland is down to one theological seminary. One major seminary. A lot of the priests around Los Angeles were graduates of Maynooth. That's where any seminarian who went to Maynooth was going to leave Ireland forever and go out to wherever. I could sign up for lots of places. Okay? Maynooth is long ago closed. Poland. Staunch Catholic, and yet we're seeing people stepping aside from it. Not necessarily becoming anti, it's just who needs it. That's the attitude that kind of gets out there. So, what we have to remember is we have a God who allows us to make mistakes. And God uses then our mistakes in our favor. So, we have to come, if we could come to God by obeying the laws, then we wouldn't have any need for God. We have to overcome the stumbling stone, which is moving away from law, and then we begin to come to the wisdom level of consciousness. God's level. Okay? And Rohr's last sentence in this chapter, when you have come out of the boxing ring, the necessary but creative tension of law and grace, you will know that you have won the match, but technically, you will have won by losing. That's not a bad summary, okay? So, two things, that last sentence and the Dalai Lama, okay? Very well.